Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to a festive edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. We are here to talk about our favourite films of the year, as well as some alternate festive favourites. I am Jake Cunningham, and joining me is Irene Musumeci.
Hello, Merry Christmas.
And Sam Howlett.
Happy New Year.
How are you all doing?
Very
feeling
well.
Feeling stressy and Christmassy. Perfect.
I'm not stressed, I'm very happy. Yeah. Very comfortable.
You're full of the festive spirit.
It's a
pint of Baileys you're drinking.
It is, yeah. I've had six today.
Yeah. All right. So what are we watching? Normally we review what we've been watching. What will we be watching this Christmas?
Well, I think that the Christmassiest city in the world is New York, and film cinema seems to know this as well. You've got a lot of Christmas films set in New York. You've got Elf, Home Alone 2, although Home Alone 2 is now ruined by a cameo by Donald Trump, mm-hmm. so it's unwatchable. But I'm going to pick a film that is set in New York. It's set in the Christmas season of New York, and that is Mary Harron's adaptation of Bret Easton Ellis' masterpiece, American Psycho.
Great choice, and a great film.
Yeah, it's Christmassy.
It is, there's a Christmas party.
There's a Christmas party, there's mistletoe, there's snow, everyone's wearing their big winter coats, a lot of scarves.
A lot of red. Yeah, very festive.
Also a lot of murder, but that's kind of like a side note.
Well, that could be an unexpected result of Christmas.
Maybe
particularly
in some,
if your
yeah.
family celebrations don't
Absolutely,
go the way
yeah.
they should.
That's a really nice one that the Bechdel Test Fest screened,
right.
kind of bending their own rules slightly, but just kind of showing how it's a film so totally about masculinity.
Yeah, well, toxic the most toxic masculinity can get is American Psycho, and yet it's directed by a woman, which is great.
Yeah, and Mary Harron should be doing more. Like she's
yeah,
doing
it's
TV
a real shame.
Movies,
yeah,
she's so talented. I look forward to you showing that to your kind of grandparents.
Yeah, when the whole family's around, kids, toddlers, American Psycho. I mean, it's actually, excellent. I think I often forget that American Psycho has got at least like 40 minutes an hour before the first kill. So for a while, you're not really sure what you're getting into.
Mm. Does it qualify as slow cinema then?
I mean, I'm not really sure. It's also got an incredible soundtrack, which I don't think qualifies as slow cinema either.
Yeah. That is this way. Where you're going to take the podcast on a 40-minute tangent? Maybe about Genesis or
Genesis.
Phil Collins.
Do you like Hugh Lewis and the News, guys?
Yeah. Well, talking about Christmas films that perhaps take a while to get going before there are many, many murders, I enjoyed Krampus for the first time yesterday. And I think I'm going to put that on the shelf as a regular Christmas classic. I did watch it with my girlfriend's parents, who may be perhaps not into your postmodern comedy horrors, as most people will be. And I think, because the start of the film is very much in the vein of Home Alone kind of comedy, in that it's a lot of people and a lot of family members, and they don't quite get along.
Yeah.
And there's this side of the family and that side of the family, and one's Democrat and one's Republican, and the grandma's turned up and no one invited her, and it's this kind of comedy that maybe does go on a bit too long before the murders, but then the murders start happening and it's great, and it's based on Bavarian folklore about this knight version of Santa called Krampus, who's pretty savage and it's got hooves and horns and a quite nightmarish gang of
evil elves
and toys that eat children, and it went to some places I wasn't expecting. And
this is a really dark film, actually.
Yeah,
Krampus.
A lot of children do suffer quite terrible fates, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and it's directed by Michael Dougherty, who made a film called Trick or Treat, which went straight to DVD in the UK, but it's really fun.
Well, it kind of opened up a new vein to me that I need to check out the other ones. There's like Better Watch Out and Silent Night, Deadly Night. Which have got these great... There's so much Christmas potential.
Silent Night, Deadly Night, I believe, is the one where Santa kills someone with an icicle.
Brilliant. Rena, well, what are you watching?
When you sent me the task of thinking about Christmas films, I went very earnest because I absolutely love Christmas. And it's a time when I actually watch a lot of old classics. So I'll be rewatching A Matter of Life and Death, which is currently in cinemas as well. And It's a Wonderful Life. I watch every year. And then there's a few kind of recent traditions that my family has started adopting, because as we know, Christmas is all about the family. Mm-hmm. So ever since we got our first VHS player, which was probably 1988, if I don't remember wrong, we have had a tape of The Godfather dubbed into Italian, which is pulled out every Christmas, and we rewatch it traditionally, everyone together after our six-hour meal. There is actually a Christmas scene in The Godfather. He gets shot on Christmas Eve. The Don gets shot on Christmas Eve. And so it's perfectly justifiable and justified as a choice. Most of us kind of sleep through it by that stage. But one amazing thing happened a couple of years ago when I brought my then new boyfriend and now my husband over to Italy, who doesn't really speak a lot of Italian and had never seen The Godfather. And so I had to explain to my parents that we were going to go with a tradition, but this time we will watch the film on DVD in the original language with Italian subtitles. And lo and behold, a Christmas miracle happened. My dad could actually quote along with the entire script in Italian and did this kind of live dubbing thing going on. It was really quite experimental and wonderful. So yeah, I'll be rewatching The Godfather as usual every year. Although I have just watched an extraordinary Christmas film, which is John Huston's The Dead, which actually takes place, I think, on the 6th of January, Twelfth Night, which is the last day of Christmas.
Right.
And it's a fantastic adaptation of a short story by James Joyce. It's the short story at the end of The Dubliners, and really kind of gives the meaning of Epiphany, a whole new sort of literary concept. And it's absolutely fantastic. It's got Angelica Houston in it, full of atmosphere, and I would thoroughly recommend it.
Irina, keeping it in the family this Christmas. You mentioned A Matter of Life and Death. For listeners of this show, do head over to our Twitter, where you can actually win one of the very, very lovely posters that have just gone out for the restored version of that film. Those are really, really nice, so do make sure you check that out and see if you can win one that we've got available for you. And we must move on, as it is the most wonderful time of the year, the time of the year when every culture article has to be condensed into a nice short list so everyone knows exactly what is right and what is wrong and what is best and what is worst. And so we will start by actually spreading our wings outside of the pod booth and around into Curzon's cinemas and Curzon's head office to talk to a number of different staff members all about their favourite films of the year.
All right, so first up, we've got Stephen Ryder, who works in Curzon Aldgate, and he's going to tell us about his favourite film of the year, which is A Ghost Story.
I think that what separated it from a lot of the other films for me was how experimental it was with its structure. And its pacing, because I think these days with the overload of kind of very similar stuff we're getting in cinema, although that varies in quality a lot, this in particular, just from the first half an hour, struck me as something that was going to be very, very different. It starts off incredibly slow. I think within that first kind of half an hour, you get two or three shots that last a few minutes at a time where there's barely anything going on. You remember the scene where they're lying in bed together?
Yeah.
The scene where the bed after, you know, spoiler alert, Casey Affleck's character dies, but it is in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And there's another one as well. Oh, Rooney Mara's the pie eating scene,
yeah.
Which has kind of come as a symbol of the movie, I think, the one that people keep returning to. But yeah, I mean, it's the pacing and the structure of it is so experimental, and it's a film like that's about time and about how time works for human beings, which is a kind of a very ambitious theme, I think, to undertake, and they do that through the character of this ghost. I think I've described it before as, like, instead of being a life story, it's like an afterlife story about what happens after this guy dies, and you know, we get to explore his feelings in the afterlife, his rejection of the afterlife, his return to the kind of real world. And I think that it's a really ambitious project for Lowry, and it's a very challenging film, and I think it's people have told me that they dislike it, and I do totally understand that because it is a challenging film. but yeah, for me, it was just, I loved how it took a different path from a lot of things we're doing nowadays.
It's really interesting in terms of, like, marketing as well. because the lead actor is not really on screen often.
Well, no, he is under the sheet though.
Right.
And I think if that is Casey Affleck under that sheet, which I don't think, you know, we'll ever really know for sure, then it's actually, I think, a really good physical performance from him. Like, there's a lot of physicality going on under there, I think, and you really feel something, whether that's from the direction or from Casey himself, I don't know. But the limited amount of screen time that he does get, I think he does something with it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's coming off his Oscar win last year, obviously, and this is a, you know, he's worked with Lowry before on, remind me what the film was?
I think it was Ain't Them Body Saints.
Ain't Them Body Saints, yeah. Which I actually haven't seen yet. I should probably see that. And obviously Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck worked together on that one. So I think Lowry saw something in him for this role, and I think it works. I think he's a very quiet character. He's very subdued compared to Rooney Mara, who's very kind of combative in the relationship. Right. She likes to you know, call him out, and he doesn't seem to like to talk at all, and which is kind of ironic. I guess I've not thought about this before, but it's kind of ironic that when he's a ghost, he wants to express all these things now, and he can't do it. So, I mean, there's so many layers to the film. I mean, we've spoken about the fact that it's about time. Now, in the movie, it's got this bridge in between with the Will Oldham doing the party going, the party goer who rants and does his big speech, kind of expository speech, which some people have really hated. Mm. I thought it was fantastic, but some people really hate that scene, which I think is great. I think that's fantastic that people are having those kind of reactions to it. And then after that kind of bridge scene, the film just starts to speed up, and we start jumping ahead in time, and all these slow scenes that have come before, you know, there's now scenes that last kind of in the blink of an eye rather than and I think that kind of sudden juxtaposition of pacing is just like fascinating, but then obviously you've got the grief in the film as well, and that kind of side of things, and the grief from both the ghost and from Rooney Mara's character. So there are layers to it. I'm still discovering them now. I've seen it three times now. Wow. So
I think the best thing about it is that it kind of throws these big questions up about time and humans' relation to their own like personal space and the domestic space, but it doesn't really answer them. It's just about, you know, join us as we just look at these things, but we don't actually have an answer for you.
That's probably why people have had a bad reaction to it as well. but yeah, I mean, I'm drawn to those kind of films in general, interrogative films that don't aim to answer questions, but do pose them. Because I think that's what film's supposed to do in a way. We all want a kind of film that does give you answers sometimes. There's no harm in that. But I mean, I think one that keeps you thinking like a ghost story does, and one you can keep returning to and discovering new things. I think this is going to be a film that people look back at when they look back at 2017.
Right.
And this is going to be one of those ones that stands out. I know we've got, you know, things like Get Out and Call Me By Your Name at the moment, which are getting a lot of praise, which are great films, both in my top 10 of the year. But, you know, there's a chance that they might get kind of, as people look back at this year, in 20 years, 20, 30 years' time, that this might be a film that kind of, I think, rises to the top. We'll see.
Brilliant. Stephen, thank you.
No worries.
Cheers. Okay, next up, we're hearing from Stephen again, and joined by Kelly Pell, also from Curzon Aldgate, as they talk about The Florida Project. So both of you put The Florida Project in your top 10.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it in your top 10?
I think because it's a film that we don't see a lot of anymore. I think it's a meandering film. It doesn't have a firm plot structure. I mean, if it did, it was hidden. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a film that gave us time to connect with characters, put us in the world of the, you know, the lead character, who's a 5-year-old child, and I think it did it very well. And I think it made you feel something, and it also left things up, you know, to the imagination and for you to put together. And it was also about, you know, what they didn't show, a lot of things that they left out.
Yeah,
I think that it was a special film, I think, as well, you know.
No, I totally agree with that. Yeah, I totally agree with everything you said. I think I heard Sean Baker, when he was at the London Film Festival, say that he was looking to make The Little Rascals, but for the kind of 21st century. And that kind of meandering nature to it and that humour, I think it reminds us kind of all of our childhood a little bit, right? How we didn't really have a definitive structure to our lives.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And memory and like how, you know, the child's sort of perspective, which is very untainted and quite optimistic and, you know, it's fantastic and mystical. And I think all of those elements are present in the film as well.
Yeah, what you said about the film being a lot of what it doesn't show.
Yeah,
exactly. Totally agree. Because it's, if you were to show the kind of things, a lot of the stuff seems to happen behind like closed doors, which as a child, like, that kind of, you know, behind closed doors and not being allowed into places was something we all kind of felt.
Exactly.
And yeah, I think the fact that Mooney is so optimistic about the world around her, that that's why the ending hits you kind of so hard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even as the world, so like if the whole film was from, what's the mother called?
Hayley?
Yeah.
Is it Hayley?
Yeah, it's Hayley. So like if it was all from her perspective, this would be a very different film
because,
you know, the world around them is, you know, so brightly coloured, but it's as if it's been painted over, you know, as if everything needs to look pretty for the tourists. Mm-hmm. But really, this is quite, you know, extremely poverty-stricken people we're watching.
Yeah.
But through the eyes of a child, those bright colours seem even brighter.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, go on, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I just had a thought while we're having it. But I think it's also almost like, I really love stories that are on a micro level, tell very universal stories.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you on a micro level, yes, we're looking at this particular place, these particular kinds of people, you know, lower income. It's not a mistake that you called it the Florida Project because of the associations with, you know, the American projects. But I think, as you were saying, like, you know, painted over for the tourists and this particular area in Orlando, you know, like for the tourists and it's got this weird in-between sort of like, oh, we're good, we're fine, our economy's okay, and like everyone's doing all right, and this jazz hands kind of thing. It's kind of the same thing that I think society does in general, you know, and films in particular that reiterate that kind of, everything's fine, and like the world is structured, and we are following this narrative, you know, plot, and like, it, you know, it's going to be a happy ending.
It's repression. It's,
you know, and it's total repression. Exactly. So something like this that is exploring that just in its form, it's in and of itself, it's interesting, and I think adds another layer, you know, to like look into it.
And, I mean, what you just said about it being painted over, really, really interesting, because I don't know how you guys found, but when I first watched it, I felt that even though I loved it, I was concerned a little bit with the kind of the labels like poverty porn.
Right.
You know, because this is a kind of a white kind of middle class. I don't know Sean Baker's life, but he's a director working in the industry now, and he's had a hit film kind of making a movie about people who are incredibly poor. And how much are we like reveling in that idea?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that.
Yeah, now,
exactly.
Like,
yeah, exactly. Mm. I think it's a valid point, but I think that the tenderness in which he tells the story and the characters all have dignity and agency. Mm-hmm. And,
exactly, and that's what he did with Tangerine as well.
Yeah.
And in a film, these would be seen as, oh, their life is so hard. Look at these people. Look how poor they are and everything. But this is, for most part, quite a joyous film, right?
I'd agree. I think that that's why he kind of had to do it from Mooney's perspective, from a 5-year-old's perspective. I think that's why he gets away with it, because that's what the film is actually about, I think, is the idea that, you know, you, even though you're kind of living in poverty as a child, you don't know that. Mm. You can still have fun. You can still be happy. You can still live your childhood as exciting and as kind of full of joy that other children do, which again, coming to the ending of the film, when you see all that fall apart for Mooney and the reality kind of hits her,
it makes it even more impactful, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mm. Because all the way through the film, she's been this confident, kind of boisterous young lady who's kind of like in the midst of like childhood and happiness and exploring the world. And all of a sudden that just all, the facade just drops away for her. And it's, pretty devastating.
Yeah, it raises interesting questions, I think. It's not saying that what the mother's doing is right or wrong. It's not passing judgment on it. I mean, you do see that there are elements that, you know, they are risks and dangers to letting children look. Like, there are amazing aspects where they can create their own universe and live this fantastical world, but there are also the dangers of that, you know, and he kind of shows that in both parts. But then it also, again, raises an argument about, like, what is better for a child, you know, like, what is society deems is okay for a kid versus, like, you know, she's okay in this world with her mother, and like, as much as the mother's struggling, she doesn't know. It's interesting.
Kelly, Stephen, thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
No worries, cheers. Thank you.
Next up is Kate Gerover, who will be talking about one of her favourites of the year, Wonder Woman.
And we've just had a discussion round the table. Something that Jake and Sam aren't saying here is that apparently I've picked a really uncool...
In the grand scheme of end of year lists, when everyone wants to pretend to their friends how cool they are, they tend not to pick blockbusters because it looks better to pick the kind of cooler indie art house film.
Of course it does.
But I mean, in terms of actual social impact, which is what we look for in art, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Wonder Woman this year.
Cultural achievement.
Yeah, nice.
It's probably had a huge impact.
I think it's had a huge impact, I have to say. But not particularly on me, because I'm way, way too old, really, to choose Wonder Woman as my film of the year, as I can still remember the series very, very well, and that's my favourite thing. Right. But I think people were a bit sniffy about Wonder Woman. They were like, is it going to do the business? It has done the business. It is directed by a woman. She is going to direct another one. And I thought Gal Gadot was brilliant as Wonder Woman. I don't care that she's only wearing little hot pants or whatever they are, because that girl can fight in real life as well, not just even on screen.
Yeah.
And I know that loads of girls and women saw that film and came out inspired. I came out needing a hearing test. It was loud. I will say that about the film. It's very, very loud.
Yeah.
And it does go on for quite a long time. But if we take those two things away, I think it is a cultural moment. And God knows we need it this year.
Because it's not like we haven't seen this Wonder Woman. This is actually the third time that she has appeared on our screens. But this is the only time that you've actually... This is the Wonder Woman that we want to see, compared to the Wonder Woman that maybe appeared in Justice League, which felt like a completely different representation of the character, or the one that appeared in Batman Superman.
Yeah.
I think because of the people behind the camera proved to be just as important as the characters in front of it.
I agree.
And that's why so many people have come out of Wonder Woman being so impressed and empowered by it.
This film had everything to prove. This had a real hard time being released, I remember people had written it off before they saw it, but it was, what a surprise it was.
I actually think she was the best thing about Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, I agree.
But you know, we have to talk about the sort of previous year. Was it previous year Ghostbusters? What a hard time Ghostbusters got. And there was such sort of ridicule across, you know, the internet about it. And I watched the film. It was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Why do... You know, it's just like as soon as you put women behind the camera or in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the fact is that we just want to make films, not me. When I say we, I mean it's a royal we. I do not want to make a film. That will not happen. But yeah, so Wonder Woman. There you go.
Brilliant. Thanks, Kate. And now, Kate Kane from Curzon's Distribution, discussing Aki Kaurismäki's The Other Side of Hope and why it's her favourite film of 2017.
It's a film that tackles a tough subject in a humorous way. It has real humanity. It doesn't beat you over the head. And actually, even if it was about something else, it's just a pure joy to watch his films. He has such a style to the way he shoots, and the humor that he have is very much in keeping with my own, the sort of dry, dark. He is just somebody who just makes films with a real sense of humanity and a real... wanting to stir emotions in the audience, but without beating you over the head with it. I think he's really intelligent, and I could watch his films all day. It's a shame he doesn't make them faster, because I could watch an Aki Kaurismäki film every year and be very, very happy with my life.
And it's black comedy. It's not like a kind of a thick, tarry blackness to get bogged down.
No.
It's actually surprisingly light, and you try and tell people what this film is
about.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
that's quite hard.
It's a comedy. People are going to struggle with that.
They will do, but then, I mean, it is quite hard to sort of do. I think we specialise in these kind of films, like with Ruben Östlund and all these filmmakers, where it's like... It's one of those things where it's like you just have to hope that word of mouth is strong, because there's a sushi scene in this film which just makes me laugh out loud. And you can't tell anybody why it's funny, because it just ruins the joke. Yeah. But it is like I had tears running down my face, because it's just these little moments of... It's like it's a visual gag, but it also works on so many other levels. And he's just... I just think he's so sophisticated. And you know, he's just... I always leave his films with a really sort of emotional, I have to go out and have a cigarette or have a coffee, or, you know, just do that and just sort of take it all in, because that's what I want from a filmmaker. I want someone that really fizzes my blood and makes me feel something, can think on a film and then go and tell people, please go and see this film, because because he's one of the greatest living directors.
Yeah, and it's got kind of a slow burning gut punch right at the end mm-hmm. as well, which you don't really notice happening.
Yeah,
and then it's only as you say after you've sat on it for a bit and you've had a coffee and you've had a think and a sleep and you realise how much heart and emotion really is at the centre of this film, and that's what's driving it. And obviously, it's a film about a Syrian refugee, so it should have that at the centre.
Exactly.
Of it. But you don't get too bogged down in the politics of it. So then, once you actually think about it, you can think about the politics of it and what it's trying to say, and you realise how important this film is.
He's like a sort of Finnish Ken Loach, where he despairs of the government and he despairs of, you know, what's being done to help these people, and they're just sort of at a loss, and there's bureaucracy and it's all just sort of box ticking and like, okay, well, we'll help these people, but they're not helping them and these people are really struggling. And he sets about putting humanity, I keep saying the word humanity, but it is like that's what his films are to me, and he sort of puts it front and center and does it in a way. I mean, we've done films like Fire at Sea, which is the same thing, where you're just like, it's so traumatic what happens to these people, and it's got attention, but it's still not enough attention because it's still going on and people are, you know, dying in these boats and all these kind of things. But Fire at Sea, I think, was too tough. People found it too distressing to watch, and I understand that, and we bought it because we just thought we have to show this film. But The Other Side of Hope manages to take a similar subject. You know, this guy has come from the most horrendous conditions, and it starts with a gag. Like, you know, it's a film about Syrian refugees, and it starts with an amazing joke at the beginning that's just, you sort of can relax a little bit and think, well, okay, I'm not being patronized, or this isn't going to be a 90-minute lecture or something like this. It's like, it's a story of two men and how their lives interject, and all of his films are like that. La Havre is another one. You know, he's sort of, I think it's very smart.
Yeah. Is it 7 years since La Havre? Is that the gap between?
Something like that. It was released just when I started here, so maybe 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's what I mean. It takes a while. It's like Roy Anderson almost, right, where you're just like, come on, just stick a green screen on it. Do another one.
All
right. And killer soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
Really great. The band.
Very good. They when they did the premiere in Berlin, they had a party afterwards, and it was as you'd expect, there was booze and smoked herrings and everybody was smoking, and their band came on and did this set, and it was just brilliant. I just had the best time afterwards and was just telling everybody about it, and like, it, I don't know, the whole thing is everybody who worked on this film, like the sales agent and all the crew and all of that, they're just like so full of love for it, and I feel the same, and actually all of us in the team just felt the same afterwards. It's just like, it's a joy, it's a treat to work in film, and it's a treat to find a film like this where you just think, oh, that's what it's all about really. And and they don't all have to be sort of wrist-slittingly, I mean, a lot of them are, but but then the other thing is that this film actually is different to the script, so the ending was different in the script, so I had a pleasant surprise at the ending because I was prepared for something a lot darker, and then he obviously, I don't know, he's just decided to change the way he did it, and I think it worked.
And now we're joined by Ryan Hewitt, who's going to tell us about his favourite film of the year, Good Time.
Not just film comments number one and film of the year, my number one
more
film
importantly
of the year. Absolutely, far more important in the ranks. So, Good Time, film from this year by the Safdie brothers, a couple of guys born and bred in Queens and Manhattan, New York, and that environment completely infects everything that they've made so far. They have had a couple of films before now, most notably Heaven Knows What from a couple of years ago, but Good Time is very much their, I think it's going to be their calling card. It's the one that's really going to announce them to a lot more people.
Mm. Well, I think they've already springboard into new projects as well.
Exactly. Yeah. They've got Uncut Gems coming up next year, I believe, produced by Martin Scorsese.
Remake of 48 Hours.
Remake of 48 Hours, perfect film for them, I think. Definitely. Very much in the same kind of vein as Good Time. Yeah. Good Time doesn't necessarily have... Good Time is a lot like 48 Hours, actually. And it's like it's got 24-hour period, pretty much. Mm. And it's madcap, and all the kind of things happen to characters rather than them necessarily going out and making things happen. So, for quickly to catch up on what it's about. So you've got this guy named Connie, played by Robert Pattinson, like you've never seen him before. he is born and bred in Queens. He's very much a product of his environment, street smart and savvy kind of guy, hasn't had a lot of breaks in life. and is a bit of a hustler, but with that comes a lot of charisma. He's a bit of a manipulator. He knows how to work people. He knows how to lean on his good looks and his charm. And he's desperate to get out of Queens, but he won't do that without his brother Nick, who suffers from some learning difficulties, so is very vulnerable in Queens, and particularly in their part of Queens, their existence. So he hatches a plan to rob a bank, and from the proceeds of that bank robbery, they will escape. But it doesn't quite go to plan. Nick ends up in prison, and then Connie really comes to life. He kicks into survival mode, and he spends the next 24 hours doing absolutely anything necessary to rescue his brother from wherever he may be.
I read someone describe it as muscular filmmaking. Mm. And initially I thought, I don't actually know what that means. But then looking at it, I think you're actually looking at the complete intensity and strength in vision behind it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think that means. That the Safdie brothers clearly know exactly what they want to do. And they really throw their weight around with every aspect of the filmmaking.
Yeah.
The camera, you are so aware of it. Mm. Like, it really throttles you. It moves around. Everyone's face fills up the screen. The soundtrack is always there.
It's unrelenting.
The performances are like volume 11.
Yeah.
Everyone is really smashing it. And I think that's what I loved about it.
It's ferocious, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's completely unrelenting, completely uncompromised. What I really like about the Safdies, and particularly in Good Time, is that they are very much influenced by film culture. They have clearly taken in everything Scorsese's ever done, everything Paul Schrader's ever done, Abel Ferreira, all these key New York filmmakers. Yeah. But they don't seem to be just replicating it. They're not just sort of doing little nods or little winks and things like that. It's a product of all of these things combined. Mm. But it's unique. They have something unique about them. And it's particularly in 2017 or the 20-teens, to have something so aggressive as what they're doing in American film is quite rare. And I think that they're just doing this mutant hybrid of everything from the 70s, the gritty New York, the 80s soundtrack feel, and it's got this 90s sort of styling in the costume in particular. But then it coalesces into something new and feels fresh, despite being completely referencing so much.
American indie scene at the minute seems to be very much around the Baumbach kind of
popularity. Yeah, the intellectual kind
of that's what it's
brownstone
about.
Thing.
Yeah, Girls, films of Ira Sachs, that kind of thing. And then even films like Judd Apatow films are a variant on that are just bit more
thick, a bit broader.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And then these guys just come in and completely flip that on its head.
Yeah.
And there's a reason that this film is playing at Cannes. And it's just smashing it out there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so good. I'm so pleased that we're talking about it on this show and that it is cropping up on end of year lists.
Yeah.
People are watching it.
And there's something about a film set within a 24-hour time period that has just so much energy and so much watchability. It's kind of you're talking about the films that influenced it. The Warriors, I think, is a big one as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sort of, you've got to get from place A to place B and stay alive. That kind of mentality to it is so, you're just so involved in it.
And Walter Hill's another one of those names, isn't he? The Warriors and them doing 48 Hours.
Right,
Of all the people to remake 48 Hours, if it really has to happen, I'm glad that it's the Safdie brothers.
Yeah.
Because they know that, they seem to know that environment so well, and they seem to be quite happy to push the boundaries.
Yeah. And I just want to quickly mention Robert Pattinson, because he's had a grinder of a year as well. Because I don't know if Lost City of Zed was in either of your guys' picks for the end of the year, it certainly was for mine, and I think he's brilliant in that. And he's just signed up for a Claire Denis sci-fi film as well.
Right.
So he's making some tremendous choices, and I'm just really excited to see what he's doing.
I think this year we've had some really good A-list actors and actresses appearing in weird stuff, Killing of a Sacred Deer, this, and then Mother. Hmm. They're not really comparable in all the way, but they're also just it's great that these big actors are willing to do these smaller, quirkier films.
But no, your point about Robert Pattinson is very, very true. For me, I was probably not prepared to accept him before this year because I
Twilight.
Couldn't get over myself.
Because your heart was broken.
Twilight thing.
Yeah, how good he was in Twilight.
Exactly. Yeah, he can never live up to that. But this year with Lost City of Zed, when he showed how good he was in that smaller supporting character role and then just absolutely ran away with it in Good Time, he's now one that I'll look out for, one that I'll go and see. It's an extremely impressive performance.
Mm. Well, Ryan, thank you so much. Have a good time this Christmas. And now we must get on to the top 10. Because, Irene, your working week the last 7 days has just been compiling everyone's top 10. I saw the list. There's a lot there that you had to sift through.
Yes, this is kind of the pain and the joy of my life every time this time of the year comes along. We receive lists from quite a few people, a very diverse group of voices and experiences and interests. And so it's fantastic that they're all represented on the Curzon blog. You can read everyone's lists. But I believe you have done the fiendishly terrible job.
The fun task of assigning every film a numerical value upon where it appeared in everyone's list, and then using those numbers to figure out the Curzon top 10. And there was a lot. I've got a little page in front of me, and it was one of five or six pages that were filled with lots of different films. And so it was great to see such a diverse spread. And so I'm going to start with some honourable mentions that didn't quite make the cut. And those are The Red Turtle, Michael Dudok-Dwick's film with a collaboration between Wild Bunch and Studio Ghibli, which is an almost silent kind of meditation on pretty much life itself, and but just set on a little island with a red turtle. Loved it. That was in my top 10 and didn't make it. We've also got Dunkirk, didn't quite cut.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's a surprise.
Neither did, heartbreakingly, Paddington 2.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That is just wrong,
yep.
Can I just say?
I can only assume people haven't seen it, and that's why it didn't make the cut.
That's the error of their ways.
Yeah. And we just talked about it with Ryan. Good time. Just three places out of hitting the top 10, which is a real shame. And last year's big kind of art house hit all across Europe, Tony Erdmann.
Mm.
2 points shy of missing the top 10.
Such a shame.
Yeah. And we've already had a brief discussion about it, I say. You have with Stephen, A Ghost Story. The one point, single point from breaking the top 10. All right. So those are our honourable mentions. And we will start with our 10th place, which is Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women.
I saw this a while ago. LFF 2016.
It was best film of the festival then.
It was, yeah. No, it's a really good film, really, really slow, meditative look at the very different lives of three women. Yeah, really great film. It's one of the kind of, because I saw it so long ago, it's kind of not one I thought about for a while. But yeah, really great. Was it Kristen
Stewart, Laura Dern, Michelle Williams?
Yeah.
Fantastic cast. Yeah.
And there's a small part by Jared Harris, which is kind of crucial in the Laura Dern episode. Yeah. And I thought that episode absolutely grabbed me.
Same.
And I was straight into the deep end with this film. I loved it. It's my number two of the year.
Yeah.
So I'm very pleased that it made the top 10.
Yeah. What's interesting, when I was compiling this, as much as I love writing down numbers, and my second favorite thing was actually noticing that there was a lot of films that either kind of hit 10, like top, like number one 10 points, or they went one.
Right.
Like they were kind of like either someone's very favourite or they were liked.
Mm.
And there was a few films like that, and there are a few films that were all fives and sixes.
Mm.
And everyone kind of agreed that these are really good,
but they're not quite there. Yeah.
And one of them is Certain Women, that is there because it had so many number ones and number twos, and yourself included.
Yeah, that's great to see. That's great to see.
And now a remnant from, I would say, last year, and this is obviously a conflicting time when we're building these lists, it's Manchester by the Sea is in ninth place.
Yeah, Manchester by the Sea was released in January this year, so I think it's really a testament to the fact that it's endured so much in people's memory that it was so high on so many lists. I found it an excellent piece of screenwriting, truly something that goes in depth into the mind of one character. I felt a little bit ambiguous about various things that had to do with the context of the film and perhaps what we now know about its star, which I think I would like to sort of take into account when I make my top 10 lists of the year. So it wasn't one of the top 10s, but certainly I would like to praise the writing in it and the script, and the direction was really supportive of that writing.
Yeah. Well, despite the rules that you set out for us on this task, Irene, I just didn't even think
of the
films that were last year's Oscar films as being this year's.
Yeah,
and
same.
It's stuff like festivals and screenings that we go to that kind of mess it up for you. And I saw as you saw Certain Women, London Film Festival 2016. That is, 15 months ago now? I'm not
I'm not thinking about it, yeah. But I'm very happy it's in the top 10. Yeah. Because it is an amazing achievement in writing.
Yeah. Right. At number 8, we've already talked about it. It's Sean Baker's The Florida Project.
Yeah, me, Kelly, and Stephen spoke about this earlier. And also, we have our podcast interview special with this with Willem Dafoe and Sean Baker.
Yeah, you had a great time on that one, didn't you?
Brilliant.
Yeah. It was a great interview. He just seemed to be so nice.
He was just so Willem Dafoe about everything, yeah.
Willem Dafoe, who is not a villain, despite the fact you told him, yeah?
Yeah. My mistake, sorry.
All right. At number 7, Blade Runner 2049.
Ooh.
Cool. Yeah, this was like mid-list for me. What a great showcase of what a blockbuster can be.
Well.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It is the only blockbuster in the list. Interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
And, well, we talked with Kate during our brief chat about that maybe at the end of the year, sometimes people want to look cool and they don't put blockbusters on their lists. And maybe that's a testament to Blade Runner 2049.
I think so, yeah. And I think this just had everything going for it as well. I mean, we call it a blockbuster, but I think Blade Runner kind of transcends the label of blockbuster in a way.
Oh, wow, that's a big label.
Well, you know what I mean? I think when you think of blockbuster, I sort of think of Independence Day or the Avengers, stuff like that. But I think Blade Runner, which when it was first released was a commercial failure, has grown to become considered a blockbuster, even though it wasn't. Mm. And I think that's testament to this sort of, there's this huge love for it, both within the industry, within critics, and within audiences as well.
It's also definitely trying to grapple with some existential question that may not be perhaps what the average blockbuster aims to do. I mean, obviously, Dunkirk was another example of this kind of blockbuster, and it's interesting that it didn't make the list. Blade Runner 2049 did not make my list, I'm afraid. I did not love it. I had very serious trouble with its treatment of female characters, and I found it very beautifully shot, but ultimately I thought its philosophy left me not even conflicted, but just kind of going back to A-level set texts, which is a bit damning. I didn't get with it at all.
I don't think the philosophical idea at the centre of Blade Runner or Blade Runner 2049 is anything massive. I think it's a very nice
every theory. Single film that has ever had a robot in it has explored that philosophical question of what makes a human.
Yeah. And I think at the end of Blade Runner, there is this question that needs to be answered. Apparently, everyone needed that answered. And Blade Runner 2049 comes in, doesn't answer that whatsoever, and gives us something new. And that's what I really liked about it. And next up, it is probably the most common number one film for a lot of sites. I know for Sight and Sound, for Empire.
Mm.
Here, it is at number 6. It's Jordan Peele's Get Out.
Brilliant. I thought Get Out was just a fantastic cinema experience as well as being a great film. You really had to see it in that packed room where people will laugh very uncomfortably and really kind of soak in the true horror of it, which is unveiled through the laughter. I don't know if Get Out is a comedy, really, as it's been classified for the Golden Globes, but there's certainly a lot of laughter in it, and I just thought it was a brilliant time in the cinema and really showed you what the collective power of all people watching the same thing together can really do.
Yeah.
And I guess it will have a different different perception if you watch it at home, I think.
Which is how I've seen it.
Really?
I didn't get to see it in the cinema. Oh. And because I can actually imagine those particular moments. Yeah. There is a moment with a police car, which I can imagine in the screens must have been absolutely
there was a lot of
wonderful.
Shouting at the screen. Yeah.
Yeah, and literally people jumping in their seats, you know. So it was really everything that cinema can do turned up to 11, and it was so intelligently written as well with some great, great performances by everyone involved. Yeah. And I found my great hero, Josh Lyman from The West Wing, also known as the actor Bradley Whitford, who plays this really like creepy, horrible, racist surgeon. Yeah. And he was absolutely fantastic because I went into the film thinking, oh, you're Josh Lyman, I will always love you. And then I thought, oh God, someone kill this dude. He's horrid.
This was my number two film of the year. Yeah. I loved it. I really love horror films, and we don't often get to talk about horror films on the podcast. The other one we did this year was It Comes at Night, which
and
was
Personal
on my list.
Shopper.
And Raw.
And
Personal Shopper and Raw, Oh, we did talk about loads of horror films.
Lots of horror.
But I'm really happy to see that this has made the impact that it has, both with critics and audiences as well, like audiences of people that don't necessarily love cinema like we do really like this film. And the fact that, and also you said like it's made the top, there's number one of Empire and Sight and Sound, who have very different kind of approaches to film.
It's got one of the best opening scenes that I've seen this year, really, when he's kind of there's this guy walking around this neighborhood and suddenly a song is playing, and because of the context of that song and where it's come from, and now suddenly it's playing in the dark as he's clearly being followed by somebody. It just set the tone in a way that I think was superb and really just extraordinary filmmaking.
Yeah. And I think a lot of credit has to go to Jordan Peele.
With
this, it's a phenomenal concept.
Yeah.
And executed so well. He's come out and he's called it a social comedy.
Yeah.
Which I think is a lovely way of putting it.
And I was at work the other day and I was wearing a turtleneck, and someone told me, "Oh, you look like one of the people at the auction in Get Out."
Did you burn the turtleneck?
So I thrown the turtleneck away.
Good.
Right, in fifth place, actually kind of dividing up audience, this is one of the ones that hit a lot of highs and a lot of lows on this. It's The Killing of a Sacred Deer, Yorgos Lanthimos' follow-up to The Lobster. And I can see why a lot of people have really gone for this. It's such a complete vision, it's got such a unique voice, and I think people that really love that are really, really going strong for this, because this is kind of unfiltered Lanthimos.
Yeah. It gets a lot of love, and I think people, they do love that kind of the sort of awkward this sort of nervous comedy that you can feel when you watch a Lanthimos film. It's like, should I be finding this funny? Should I be laughing at this? It's that kind of tension that I think people really like.
There's a lot of technical mastery in the film as well, just some extraordinary long takes and long shots as well, you know, when you're sort of kind of very removed from the action, and the action kind of gets closer to you by gradually approaching very, very slowly, and really the way the tension is ramped up throughout the film is excellent. I wish it had ended a bit sooner than it did. That's kind of my big qualm with the film, but it's certainly someone, you know, a film that's gonna be in a lot of top tens.
All right, fourth place, and I've got to say I would happily see this one higher. God's Own Country.
Yeah.
I really, really love this film. And we spoke to Francis Lee and Alex Coriani about it, who are the nicest guys. Like all through the year since this debuted at Berlin, like the team behind it have been so thrilled by everyone. Every audience has been so excited by it. It's gone to America and it keeps expanding theatres and it keeps going. And I think it had a run at Soho that was about 9 weeks. People just flocking to see this film. About farmers.
Very good, flocking. One of my favorite things about God's Own Country was really just watching it roll into this massive success, to the point that people on Twitter were writing not just fan fiction, but kind of an alternative sequel, you know, where the guys kind of, you know, live happily ever after, but do all of the things that kind of we imagine the countryside to be like. So they set up their cheese business that gets picked up by Liberty, and then they set up a kind of a sweater business with lambs.
Sweater's become a meme in itself.
It
like there's a little shop near where they shot it that's like been taking orders of this one jumper.
Oh,
but because
so
they... Like, they were committed to that in a kind of dogmary way, that every bit of material, every prop, every costume would have to come from a shop that they would have access to. And there was this one red jumper that everyone wants it.
That's amazing. I actually can't wait to see Francis Lee's next film, because I think his voice really came across so fresh and so interesting throughout Gods on Country. So I really wish him all the best. And I please make your film fast, because I want to see what's coming from you
next.
And
this like completely stormed the biffers, didn't it?
Yeah. And next up, it's Call Me By Your Name.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So what are we, number three now?
Yeah, the bronze on the podium. I've got to say, in terms of the point system, that is our biggest gap. From 4 to 3. Like, these top three are far ahead of the others.
Yeah, Call Me By Your Name appears on many, many lists that I've looked at this year. I think with reason, it's just one of those films that kind of grabs you by the heart and doesn't let you go. And so much in it is about, I guess, relating to the idea of what it's like to fall in love for the first time, regardless of who or what the object of your affection is. But those emotions are just explored in such a deep and articulate way in the film. We've talked a lot about it in our episode about this particular title, and it was
Did someone say the most listened to episode? Me and Irena talking.
Move over, Louis Theroux.
Yeah.
So it's really wonderful to see it do so well.
Yeah.
It's certainly got awards tipped all over the place.
Definitely,
I am heartbroken that Michael Stuhlbarg has not been nominated.
I think he's not going to be. Yeah.
This is heartbreaking.
He has the scene.
Yeah.
He has the scene, and he's also doing exactly what a best supporting actor should do, which is to support everyone else.
Yeah.
Plus, as a kind of role model and general, you know, fantasy teacher, may supersede Indiana Jones in my wildest dreams.
I think there's also Timothée Chalamet, though, definitely has a shout for best actor.
Yeah.
Not just nomination, I think even a win is on the cards, potentially.
Wow.
There's just something. There's a sort of physicality to his performance as well that's not really spoken about enough, I think. Like when he's kind of, their first scene together, he's doing like this weird like sort of climbing on his body, because he sort of doesn't know what to do with his body, because it's the first time he's used it in this way.
I talked to Luca Guadagnino about the film, and we spoke about how people are actually enjoying each other's physicality.
Yeah.
The sex in the film is fun, and it looks like pleasurable, not in the sense of like ethereal over the top pleasure. Like, this is, they're actually just enjoying themselves, and they're young, and why shouldn't they be? And you actually think, why do we not see that enough when people are actually having sex?
Sex scenes usually very slow and sensual and careful. This is just messy, and people fall over, and people,
that's it. And
but
like,
also laugh. They laugh a lot with each other, which is so nice and refreshing to see, because it's not such a serious business after all, if you think about what's going on.
I'm so pleased that maybe there are young people that might be worried about those kind of things watching the film, and it will ease their minds a bit, particularly about their sexuality. And they look at Timothée Chalamet's character, and you see that this isn't not an issue. You don't need to worry about this. And that's what I love about it. And also, he's flying the flag for pale, skinny guys taking their shirts off over summer. And I'm all for that.
There's also that fantastic scene on the final credits of the film, which is basically a close-up of his face as he sort of allows himself to cry. And I thought that was just extraordinary. Criminally, I was in a cinema where the lights were turned up for that moment. And I was still completely mesmerized by it. I thought his performance was so intense.
Yeah.
And really kind of, for me, I talked about this in the podcast. I read the novel before watching the film, and I did not like the voice, the narrative voice of the protagonist. It was just too much of it. And it was very... It felt really confused as to whether this was a 30-something telling me the story of a 15-year-old or a 15-year-old experiencing what he was experiencing. And somehow Chalamet's performance really taps into that teenage thing where you're kind of, you think you're older than you are and you act like that, but then inside there's this uncertainty and insecurity, and also this kind of deep passion, and everything that's going on in his mind is projected through this wonderfully specific and detailed performance. So I will be flying the flag for him, because I think he's great.
Yep. And that leads us to number two in our list, Silver, The Handmaiden.
Oh, fantastic. Well done.
It's my number one.
Yeah.
So I'm really glad to see it that high. Actually, this was one I saw at LFF last year, but it must have just had that much of an effect on me that it stayed with me for over a year to be my number one film.
Yeah, I think it ended up on, it was on my list. It wasn't kind of as high as yours. But maybe it was a slightly delayed release. Did it release in April or May?
April, yeah.
April, so maybe a bit more lingering. But I think it's because it doesn't get that kind of Oscar coverage. No. Like, as soon as those awards happen, you kind of switch off and forget about those things.
Yeah.
It is really criminal that The Handmaiden hasn't had the Oscars sort of all over it, because it is that kind of film. It's sumptuous. It's perfectly constructed in terms of its narrative and the way the story develops and is told. You constantly have these kind of twists and shifts of perspective, which are endlessly gripping. And it's a film that you can watch over and over again and appreciate just the depth of it. Plus, the production values of it. I mean, the costumes are wonderful. Yeah. The cars in it are extraordinary. The props are so memorable. I will never forget the appearance of that stuffed snake for obvious reasons. I'm terrified of snakes. Oh, did I say F? Sorry. See, that's what snakes do to me. But it's just so visually luscious and sensual and fun. It's really a wild ride.
Yeah, again, when I read the description of it, and then I didn't see it at LFF like you did, and I was really surprised when you came out and just said how much fun it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't kind of sold to me initially in that way. It was very much this is a taut, erotic thriller.
That's nearly 3 hours long.
Yeah.
I didn't expect much going in, I have to be honest, but it really bowled me away. I was going to say, like, I kind of struggle with making these top 10 year lists, because I'm like, is it something that really entertained me that goes on the list, or something I really admired in terms of filmmaking? Like, I've got Logan on my list, but that's hardly the most impressive filmmaking this year. But I just really enjoyed it. So I thought Handmaiden, you know, balanced those two things perfectly for me. Like, it's a genre film, and it has genre cliches in it, like the twists and turns. A lot of people think there's too many of them, I've spoken to, but I think...
That's it, like this kind of deconstruction of the gothic that it does is so clever. Like, it really goes right into the history of... credit to Sarah Waters' novel as
Of course. Yes.
But like, this is reaching in like 400 years ago, 500 years ago, into like the Bluebeard story and the kind of early gothic novels, your post-war Hitchcock films as well. And different eras of how this story has been told, and it's lifting from each one.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's leaning into the cliche, sometimes it's deconstructing it. All the way through, it's just supremely entertaining because you're constantly on your toes trying to figure out how it's going to tell this story.
Yeah, and I have heard some criticism that the sex scenes are seen by some as kind of male-gazy.
Mm.
But I've also read another thing where they're performing to each other in those sex scenes, which is a really nice way of looking at it, I think.
It's funny because I was going to say something about, we were talking about the two male protagonists of Call Me By Your Name and God's Own Country and how comfortable they end up being with each other's bodies. And I think this is very similar in The Handmaiden. Yeah. And I do think it comes down to the fact that it's a story written by a woman and from a woman's point of view. And then to me, the addition of a male director who is actually working in a very, very stylized manner really does go a long way not to sort of project that kind of male gaziness to it. The scenes are not pornographic, I would say. They're incredibly erotic and very sexy, but they are performed in this way where the characters are discovering each other and that there is something about the staginess that I think is very much connected to those tropes in the novel. And, you know, for instance, this I found is very different in films like Blue is the Warmest Color, where there is some seriously problematic frame as to where the sexuality is represented and how. But in The Handmaiden, I really felt that kind of stylization and that staginess of it, and that knowing staginess for everyone involved really did remove that. For me.
Right, so we must move on to our number one film of the year, as compiled by Curzon staff members from across the country.
Ooh.
And in very boring fashion, it's the winner of the Academy Award for Best Picture, it's Moonlight.
Ooh, fantastic.
That's interesting. It's not on my list, but I mean, it would be if we did these lists at a different time. It's just that it really feels like last year's film, and I know that, as you say, people have different personal rules if what you think. I mean, it was released in the UK this year, so it absolutely has the right to be there, but it didn't make mine. But I'm very happy. It's a worthy number one.
So it is on my list.
Yeah.
It's my number one film of the year.
Oh, cool, okay.
I did see this film in November last year, and I have subsequently seen it three times. It stayed with me in a way no other film has this year. It's doing so many of the other things that all the films that we spoke about are doing. It's got this kind of fantastic stylization of the way it presents this world that it operates in. It finds poetry and beauty in places that are downtrodden and miserable because there are humans there and there are people who are going through experiences that make them grow up and change and find themselves and find each other. Mm. It's an incredibly hopeful film. The music in it is wonderful. Yeah. My most played album of the year on mm-hmm. Spotify yep. is Hamilton the Musical. But number two is Moonlight. Moonlight, I have listened to an awful lot, I'm sure.
I have well.
It's wonderful music.
Yeah.
And some of the remixes that Barry Jenkins has been putting on Twitter, yeah. the yes. Chop Stars ones, everything. He's so, so good on Twitter as well, actually. Yeah. Barry Jenkins is great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it's honestly, it was a combination of, again, great writing by Terrell McCraney, who is an extraordinarily playwright. One of his plays will be performing at the Young Vic in January. It's called The Brother's Size. I've got tickets for it. He's just someone I really just want to hear stories from. His meeting with Barry Jenkins was truly just a meeting of titans. So it's very exciting, and I think it's a film that people will be returning to over and over and over again.
Mm. I have a fun, weird fact. So I interviewed Terrell Alva McCraney. The first thing he said to me when I walked in the room was, "Oh, I like your socks." And by chance of fate, I am wearing those socks right now.
Oh, wow. What are they?
They are that sort of...
Oh, moonlight colour socks.
This is great radio, isn't it?
Live radio.
I mean, I don't have the sort of aqua blue or sort of a turquoisey...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're very moonlight, I think.
Yeah, with the posters.
The colour scheme, those, yeah.
Very, very nice. Well, as a special treat, I think we should replay that very interview to end today's show. What do we think about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was for it.
Let's bring it
one
back.
One of my favourite interviews I've done. Yeah. So, yeah.
All right. So that is the end of the Curzon Film Podcast for 2017. We're ending on a high by declaring in a shock twist that Moonlight is the best film of this year.
It's just a shame it lost to La La Land.
Yeah, it
best
is.
Picture.
Yeah. Yeah, what a shame. All right. Well, until 2018, we will leave you with Terrell Alva McCraney and Sam Howlett. Until then, it's bye-bye from me, it's bye-bye from Sam Howlett.
Goodbye.
And it's bye-bye from Irena.
Goodbye.
Have a very, very lovely Christmas.
Okay, and we're delighted to be joined by Terrell Alva McCraney. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So congratulations on the film, and its incredible reaction and reception, and all the awards it's been nominated for. But something that's kind of caught my attention is that, so last weekend at the BAFTAs it was nominated for Best Original Screenplay, and then at the Oscars it's Best Adapted Screenplay. Mm-hmm. So could you maybe sort of explain the origins of the film and maybe give us some context to that sort of discrepancy in the awards and how it's recognised?
Well, sure. I mean, I'll deal with the easiest first, which is the discrepancy, quote unquote. The Academies, both BAFTA and the Academy Awards, are private institutions, and so they have certain scriptures that they or precepts that they place on these categories, and in one place we fit the bill in one way, in another place we fit in the total opposite. So to me, it's it's their party, so we sort of just show up and say thank you either way. So that's how that works. The way in which the script became Moonlight is a little bit of a complicated story, which I don't mind telling. It feels so it's stranger than fiction, actually. It's I wrote in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, as a kind of filmic meditation on my life in Liberty City. My mother just died from AIDS-related complications. I just graduated from undergrad, and I kind of didn't know where my life was going, and I was really terrified that I wasn't going to be able to put some very strong memories together. Again, you forget things, but you often think, okay, well, my mom or my dad will remember it for me. And so with her gone, I felt like, wow, there was going to be so much that I just didn't retain. So I just really eagerly wanted to put things down and wrestle with this question of, who were the most important people to me and my quote-unquote role models, and what I was looking at a life as a performer, as an artist, as an actor at the time. But, you know, why didn't I become a drug dealer? Mm-hmm. One of the most influential people in my life, especially from a young age, was a drug dealer. And, you know, what would my life look like if I had gone down that road, which was an invitation that I had gotten often growing up in Liberty City? So I put that down in like 60 or 70 pages or less. And then tried to move on with my life and continue writing plays. And so I had this script called Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And my friend Andrew Hevia, who's a co-producer of Moonlight the film, but also he runs a company called Borscht Film Festival, film company in Miami, which is dedicated to like getting Miami artists to create films. They were working with Barry Jenkins. And Barry had created this film called Medicine for Melancholy in San Francisco. And they were like, well, look, how do we get you to create something as beautiful as medicine in Miami? Because you're from Miami, you were born and raised there. Now, I had never met Barry, and I didn't know really who he was. I knew of his work. And then Andrew gave Barry in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And then that's how we began to have a conversation about growing up three blocks away from each other, living literally in the same neighborhood, both having mothers who struggled with addiction, which was in the piece. Yeah. Barry took that script and then rewrote it specifically to shoot Moonlight, and that's how we got here.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned the word there, like meditation. Mm. Do you see writing the play and the film as a kind of, sort of therapeutic or kind of cathartic and sort of exploring your past life in a way?
I wish it felt like a cathartic feeling. It does feel like exercising in that you are doing something about the ephemeral.
Okay.
You're doing something physical that is about things that are intangible. However, you know, at the end of it, you think of catharsis and you think, ah, something's gotten out.
Yeah.
And that's not how this feels. It feels like I've gotten something down.
Right.
It feels like I've been able to pin down a ghost or an apparition that had been floating around. And we finally got a photograph of it. So there's proof, right, that it exists. There's something meditative about that. But does it give you a sort of peace? I don't know.
Okay. There's still things to work on, I guess.
Always, yeah. There's always something to work on.
How was it giving something so personal to you to someone else? That's to say, look, take this, do what you want with it, kind of in a way. I mean, is that kind of difficult?
In two parts is the answer to that question. Because in the original conference or conversation between Barry and I, it wasn't very difficult because Barry has and had a lexicon, even without, I mean, again, I didn't know all of the things that we shared right off the bat. But because of the way he talked about the piece in such a very direct and pointy way, and again, if he grew up in that neighborhood and during that time, there was no way, and possessing the talents that he had, there was no way he couldn't bring, you know, the kind of verisimilitude and quality to it that it's impossible. Right. It's so specific, you know, it's so Miami in that way. And so I had there was no doubt in my mind that he knew that world and understood it.
Yeah.
He kept inviting me to set. And in that place, I didn't trust myself. And not because I thought he or the actors wouldn't do justice to the script, but when something's that personal and you see it happening again, you can't help but just want to get involved and sort of make it so. And then, and also the actors and maybe even Barry would have been looking to me to kind of verify and check off like, oh yeah, that's how it went.
And that's
not important at that moment.
Yeah.
In that moment, what's more important is that they're bringing their most true selves to it, which is why we have such an incredible, beautiful film.
Yeah.
That, you know, these artists really knew what they were doing, down to the cinematographer, up to the grips. I mean, these are people who are professionals and deserve all the sort of accolades they got because they did the work. And they didn't just sort of, you know, turn around and go, hey, is this exactly like it was? And so for me, the trust came in going, knowing myself well enough to go, that it's too personal to watch these scenes be played out. stay the F home, you know, and let them do their job.
And I understand they filmed in Liberty City itself. Mm. And so you said then that you kind of tried to stay away from that as much as you could?
Yeah, I stayed away. Yeah. There was no try. I stayed away.
You weren't on set at all, really?
No. I went to Barry's office maybe two or three times, and they were literally around the corner from my house.
Okay.
So I would go around there and say, hey, how you doing? And anything I can do? Or, you know, they had a casting call once, and they had a location problem at some point and they needed an elementary school. So I called, you know, people that I knew and sort of got them set up in ways that I could. But, you know, it was better that I was not on anybody's set.
So if the film had been given to someone, a director who hadn't, you know, hadn't had Barry's background or a similar background to you, would you have been even more hesitant?
It just wouldn't have happened.
Okay.
I mean, there were directors who came in before,
right?
And friends of mine who came in before who wanted to, you know, produce it, and they would say things like, "Let's do it in Chicago," or, you know, "We can totally, you know, we can extend this into a revenge film or something like that."
Yeah.
And you know, my answer was always, "No, that's okay. You know, I'm busy. I have other things to do. But thank you."
Yeah.
You know, and so the reason it became easy and the reason it happened was because when Barry said those things, it all made sense and there was like an easy yes.
Yeah.
You know, a quick and easy yes. There was no need to have to go, wait, what?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a sure thing.
Yeah. I mean, it just made sense. It just made a qualitative sense that didn't take long to think about. Whereas there have been times when people had brought suggestions for it before and I was just like, this isn't right.
So having seen the film now, and I assume you spent time with the actors, and in that sense, is it strange being around some of them? Like Marshall Ali, for example, because he plays the basis of the drug dealer that you knew growing up.
Yep.
Is it weird being around him every now and then?
It's not weird being around him. I do remember the first time I saw the film and I was with him, you know, I sort of started crying and he had to kind of pick me up. And I think in that moment, I just was really grateful to him.
Yeah.
As I am to Naomi Harris, as I am to, you know, Trevante and Andre Holland, who is a dear friend of mine and, you know, has been in every one of my plays. They just, to be able to find people who, and again, I don't know if you know the budget of the film, but it's not like we they're not paying these actors a whole great deal of money and, you know, we're not putting them up at the Ritz-Carlton when they're down there. You were just literally taking time off of, you know, Bond films and you know, Netflix smash hits and to come down and make this piece of poetry. But with such skill, that's the thing that I can't get over. None of them shirked on it because, you know, it was a lower end budget. Yeah. None of them shirked on the amount of talent that they brought forward. And even Barry, you know, Barry could have easily been like, oh, you know, this is a little thing that we're making.
Yeah.
Put his full self in it.
Sure.
Same with James, same with Adela. I mean, A24, they sort of just brought as much of themselves to it as possible. And I think, you know, you can't be anything but grateful to something like that.
I know you weren't on set, but how were the people of Liberty City with this film going on? Were they okay with it, or were they helpful?
I mean, there was a trepidation in the beginning, I think, from the neighborhood, and not because of the film's subject matter, but because more often than not, when someone comes to film inside Liberty City, they're doing either a newsreel about the violence or the poverty, or they're doing a TV show called First 48 or Cops.
Right.
Which takes place normally in, you know, poor neighborhoods, and you see, you know, see cameras chasing after a police who is chasing after somebody who is, you know, committed a crime. And so after a while, you get tired of people just showing that about your neighborhood. But eventually, you know, Barry really worked to become, you know, back ingrained into the neighborhood that he'd grown up in, that we'd grown up in. And eventually, you know, people, I remember we walked there the other day because we were just, you know, taking pictures in general. Walking by my aunt's house, and someone, you know, my cousin rode by, and he was like, "Hey, you in the neighborhood? Come by the house." And I was like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah, I'll be back there soon." He's like, "Yeah, what are y'all doing? You shooting Moonlight too?" And I was like, "No, we're not shooting Moonlight too." But it was just one of those moments where, like, the neighborhood has gotten to a point where they're like, "This is our thing now."
Yeah.
So, you know, my cousin's gonna tell me to come by the house in the middle of a shoot because, like, he doesn't care. He's like, I don't care if you're shooting. You need to come by the house and say hi. And then two,
you know, they're like, yeah, you know, well, you must be doing the sequel to Moonlight because, you know, we know you shot here, and it's just ingrained now. So I think they're pretty proud of it.
Yeah, a sense of pride in the community.
Yeah.
That's good. Okay. I mean, over the past few years, the conversation about representations of black experience in film, the gay experience in film, have become more and more important as, you know, people are seeing it's an underrepresented experience in film. And do you think the reception Moonlight's had is a sign of moving forward, progression in a way?
We can only hope. Yeah. I mean, I'm always sort of trepidatious in terms of figuring out waves of things. I think it's important that when we talk about representation, that we can't have flash in the pan moments.
Yeah.
Right? Because, for example, I was sort of sitting here or earlier, I think, figuring out how I've seen so many films about coming of age. So I think there's a film called My Brother the Devil,
right,
which deals with, you know, a Muslim family and a young man who's struggling with his sexuality, who was in gangs in East London, I think. Yeah. And it's just sort of a beautiful film, but that I've seen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but I don't know if a lot of other people have seen it. And so these sort of lulls that happen in terms of identity, people's identity in terms of color, in terms of poverty, in terms of sexuality, happen, and it's weird to me. And if Moonlight can help us not have those lulls, that's great. But I don't. It certainly wasn't created to to patch that up. It
to was avoid tokenism.
Yeah, it was created to tell a very intimate story about, you know, two young men's life in this community. But I, you know, you can always hope. You sort of hope that, okay, great, somebody will also tell a story of a young girl, you know, struggling to figure out her life in, you know, abject poverty in some other part of the world, and that will, you know, it'll have, and that it'll have a platform, hopefully, because, you know, we see now that people are eager and or at least hungry to see those stories.
Yeah. And obviously you're from a theater background. Mm. Would you like to do Moonlight as a produced play on stage? No.
Mm-mm.
It's done.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Often, I mean, it never was ever going to be a play.
Right, okay.
It was always written. I mean, it's written so differently than anything I've ever written. It literally says interior, exterior,
right, okay.
And like, you know, I don't know how. I mean, I don't know how I would get anybody to do it. One and two, it's just so beautiful as a film. Why?
Yeah. Sure.
You know.
Okay. And so, what have you got planned next? What's next on your agenda?
Well, currently, I don't know if it's next, but concurrently as this is happening, I'm looking through applications for, you know, choosing the next class for my program at the drama school, and that. So I'm reading lots of applications, and, you know, reaching out to students in that way,
okay.
Sort of figuring out what our year together would be like, and then, yeah. That's taking a lot. That and talking about Moonlight is taking up a lot of my time.
Okay, and I understand you were sort of brought under the wing of August Wilson.
Mm.
I was wondering, have you seen Fences yet?
Yeah, I have. Yeah,
I think they did it a good job.
Oh yeah.
Service.
Yeah. I mean, to share. I think, you know, it's interesting. It was really great to hear Denzel Washington talk about Barry. And Barry Jenkins and the way he created that film, and I really loved that, because that's one of the things that August was so great at. August was really great about looking at younger talent and sort of not even necessarily taking them under his wing, but just being an advocate, saying, hey, you should go see this person's work. They're a young artist, you know. And so the whole cast of Radio Golf, which was working at school where we were, he would just be like, oh, Terrell has a play, you should go see Terrell's play. And that was kind of incredible. I'll tell you a funny story that I don't often tell, which is that he brought me my first iPod.
Right, okay.
Did you know this?
I didn't know this. No.
All right, so I was his assistant, and I was a very bad assistant. I was not very good at all. Because I can't even assist my own life. Like, even now, I was like, I would be a terrible assistant.
Yeah.
But I was his assistant nonetheless, and he sort of called me up, and he said, hey, I need you to go buy my daughter an iPod for her birthday. It's coming up, and I need an iPod, one of those new fancy iPods. And I was like, well, I don't have iPods, so I don't know how that works. He's like, well, just go, I need you to go buy the best one. And so New Haven is like Oxford, in that it's, you know, it's out somewhere in the, you know, and there's Oxford and then there's the Shire around it, but there's no like iPod store at this time. That the nearest Apple store was in New York City, so I would either have to get on a train or go to Best Buy. And I get in this car and I drive all the way out to Orange, and I get, and I like, he gives me this wallet, this envelope full of like $100 bills, and I'm like, only old people do this. You know what I mean? Like, and so I get this big pack of money, and I go out and I say, I need the most expensive warranty guaranteed iPod you have, because I'm pissed at this point. I'm missing class to go get this damn iPod. So I go get it, and I come back and I'm like, here's your iPod. And then I leave. I just give it to him and I go back to class because I'm late. And so he calls me back and he's like, I need you to sit down. So he sits down and he's like, okay, you always need music whenever you write. And he gives me the iPod. Wow. Yeah. Wow. He tricked me into buying my own iPod. And I'll never forget that. Because he's just like that. He just, he always wants you to get to go. There's got to be a story towards it. There's got to be a journey towards it. Just can't be kind of there. Yeah. You always with him, you needed to understand the journey. So Andre Holland, who's in Moonlight, is in Jitney right now on Broadway, which is extraordinary. It's my favorite play, period. Okay. But also my favorite August Wilson play. And then Fences, I thought, was extraordinary. I thought the performances in Fences were extraordinary.
Incredible story. Terrell, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm sure I went way longer than I was supposed to.